What happens when a single banking house becomes more powerful than most governments? For over 150 years, the House of Morgan didn't just participate in financial markets, it essentially was the market. This wasn't some shadowy conspiracy theory. The Morgan Bank openly rescued the U.S. Treasury, created billion-dollar corporations from scratch, and financed entire wars. When financial panic struck in 1907, America had no Federal Reserve to turn to. Instead, the nation's bankers gathered at one man's library, waiting for J.P. Morgan to decide which institutions would survive and which would fail. Think about that. A private citizen, playing solitaire between meetings, determined the fate of the American economy. This story reveals how modern finance was born not from government policy or economic theory, but from the ambitions, rivalries, and raw power of a single dynasty. George Peabody, the dynasty's founder, amassed over $1 million, yet lived like a pauper, riding the penny bus, demanding halfpenny change, and spending just $600 of his $60,000 annual income. When passing his London banking house to Junius Spencer Morgan in 1864, he refused to let Morgan keep the Peabody name and forced him to purchase the lease on punishing terms. Then came transformation. After nearly dying during the Panic of 1857, when the Bank of England rescued his firm with an $800,000 credit line, Peabody poured his fortune into philanthropy. The Peabody Institute, housing for London's poor, becoming the first American to receive the freedom of the City of London. When he died in 1869, Britain transported his body home aboard a warship. Junius Morgan inherited more than a banking house. He inherited a second chance. His defining moment came in 1870 with a French loan. When Paris fell and bond prices plummeted to 55, Junius bought aggressively. When France prepaid the bonds in 1873, bringing them to par, he netted $1.5 million, catapulting him into the upper ranks of government financing. One audacious gamble transformed a modest merchant bank into a transatlantic powerhouse. The late 19th century's baronial age saw private bankers control industrial capital. Railroads and heavy industry required funding beyond individual means, making bankers gatekeepers of development. The Gentleman Bankers Code demanded proper introductions, no branch offices, no client poaching, and no advertising. This elegant facade masked vicious competition while keeping clients dependent. J.P. Morgan dominated this era. For 33 years, he sent detailed intelligence reports to his father Junius twice weekly, letters his father treasured but Pierpont later burned. This intense relationship tempered his recklessness with discipline. The Panic of 1893 revealed Morgan's extraordinary power. With U.S. gold reserves depleted, President Cleveland faced crisis. Morgan rushed through a blizzard to Washington. His Morgan Rothschild operation calmed markets. Bonds sold out in 22 minutes. But when bonds purchased at 10/4/12 soared to 119, populists erupted. Mary Lease called Cleveland a tool of Jewish bankers and British gold. Morgan had saved the nation's credit, yet Americans questioned whether any private citizen should wield such power. Turn-of-the-century America saw mergers explode from 69 in 1897 to over 1,200 by 1899. National markets emerged through better communications and transportation, while Spanish-American war victory signaled global ambitions. Wall Street pivoted from railroads to industrial trusts. Morgan viewed competition as wasteful destruction. When Charles Schwab, Carnegie's lieutenant, presented a vision for an integrated steel trust at a dinner Morgan attended, the banker saw opportunity. Within weeks, he assembled a proposal to control over half the steel business. The result? History's first billion-dollar corporation. The $1.4 billion United States Steel ignited Wall Street speculation, with the syndicate taking $57.5 million in stock for its services. Morgan had created monopoly by decree, capitalism without competition. Behind Morgan's imposing persona lay profound vulnerability. His grotesque nose, afflicted with acne rosacea, grew increasingly monstrous with age and was routinely touched up in photographs. In philosophical moments, he converted this affliction into pride, declaring it part of the American business structure. October 1907. Morgan, 70 and semi-retired, rushed from an Episcopal convention as Wall Street panicked. "They are in trouble in New York," he told Bishop Lawrence. "They do not know what to do, and I don't know what to do, but I am going back." For 2 weeks, Morgan functioned as America's central bank, saving trust companies, brokerages, New York City, and the stock exchange from collapse. The climax came November 2nd. Morgan gathered bankers at his library, commercial bankers in the East Room, trust presidents in the West Room. He played solitaire between rooms, the bronze doors locked. After all-night negotiations, Morgan forced trust presidents into a $25 million rescue pool while engineering U.S. Steel's purchase of Tennessee Coal and Iron to save the failing brokerage Moore & Schley. It worked, but proved pyrrhic. Senator Nelson Aldrich warned, "We may not always have Pierpont Morgan with us to meet a banking crisis." By demonstrating one man's extraordinary power, Morgan convinced Americans no individual should ever wield such influence again. The 1907 panic led directly to the Federal Reserve's creation in 1913. World War I elevated the House of Morgan to unprecedented international influence. Harry Davison's plan concentrated Allied purchases in a single agency, eliminating profiteering middlemen. On January 15, 1915, Morgan signed the commercial agreement with the Army Council and Admiralty. What began as a $12 million horse purchase exploded to $3 billion, almost half of all American supplies sold to the Allies. With a 1% commission, Morgan earned $30 million in fees. Tom Lament recruited Edward R. Stettinius Sr. to head the export department. Meticulous and demanding, Stettinius became the single most important consumer on Earth, purchasing $10 million in goods daily, from corned beef to locomotives to artificial limbs. By war's end, U.S. arms-making capacity eclipsed England and France combined, but suspicions arose that Morgan favored friends. General Electric, Bethlehem Steel, DuPont, U.S. Steel were all firmly in the Morgan orbit. The distribution of billions in contracts enabled Morgan to win loyalty from powerful companies, creating relationships that would shape American industry for decades. The line between national interest and private profit had never been blurrier. By 1929, Jack Morgan faced a transformed world. On Black Thursday, October 24, Thomas Lamont assembled major bankers pledging $240 million to stabilize markets, echoing 1907. Richard Whitney strode across the trading floor, bidding $205 for 20,000 shares of U.S. Steel. After trading closed, Lamont told reporters there had been a little distress selling, an understatement that became legendary. But Morgan magic failed. After a weekend pause, selling resumed. On tragic Tuesday, October 29, over 16 million shares changed hands, a record lasting 40 years. The 1933 Glass-Steagall Act delivered the final blow, separating commercial and investment banking. The Morgan empire shattered into J.P. Morgan & Co., Morgan Stanley, and Morgan Grenfell. In 1989, Morgan Bank left 23 Wall Street for 60 Wall Street, the $830 million purchase partly financed by Japan's Dai-ichi Mutual Life, unthinkable in earlier years. Yet the legacy endures. The Morgan approach revolutionized corporate finance. Their 1907 response created the Federal Reserve. When J.P. Morgan Chase emerged from the 2000 merger, it carried forward a name still representing stability. The barons are gone, but their questions about balancing innovation with stability, private interest with public responsibility, remain urgent.